supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, many of us are hooked on the notion of finding our roots. There are popular books on subjects of genealogy and genetics that, when used together, can really be powerful search engines into our families' histories and identities. Just listen to this clip from the PBS series Faces of America, hosted by Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates. He asked comedian Stephen Colbert, why is it important to know where you came from?
A lot of people look back for their ancestors for greatness, looking for your greatness in your past. And when I was a kid, I remember I used to read a lot of science fiction, and Robert Heinlein wrote in the Notebooks of Lazarus Long, he wrote, I met a lizard once who said his ancestor was a dinosaur. I almost cried. And so I, when I was pretty young, I used to think, oh, yeah, I shouldn't look for greatness in my past. Even as nice as it would be to be the descendant of Jean-Baptiste Colbert or the Earl of Tyrone, I thought, that's useless, you know? So I don't feel informed by my own identity by those people in that way, like who I am. But it's great. I knew so little about it. It's so great to know what they went through that I should exist.
That was Stephen Colbert from the genealogy series Faces of America, a lead into today's show on the connection and identity in light of the tools of genealogy and genetics. We've got a handful of guests today, Brian Sykes and Philip Hemmick, or will be our guests in the first part of the show. Brian is a professor of human genetics at Wolfson College in Oxford. His new book is DNA USA, A Genetic Portrait of America. He joins us by phone from the UK. Brian, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Philip Hemmick is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at University of California in Santa Cruz. He's written about identity in terms of narrative, politics, and sex, and we have him by phone from California. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And later on, we're going to hear from WHYY's own Shannon McDonald. She's a blogger for The Feed on Newsworks.com, and she's got her own recent history on digging into her family's past. By the way, that's WHYY.org. And we'd love to hear from you about your curiosity, your interest, or maybe your journey into searching for your past. Our number is 888-477-9499. Brian, let's start with you. The use of genetics to look into human origins is really pretty new. It's only about 20 years old. Tell us about DNA testing. How complicated is it, and what can it really show us?
Well, you're quite right, Dan. It's only about 20 years it's been used, and really only in the last 10 years has it been available to members of the public to look into their own ancestry. Basically, genetic tests come in, they're practically very easy to do. You only need to usually either give a saliva sample or a little bit of few cells from inside your mouth, the cheek cells. They're very easy and painless to do practically. But it comes in two forms. The best two indicators of the past are genes, pieces of DNA that come down the maternal line. It's called mitochondrial DNA. It follows an undiluted maternal line and can be traced thousands of years into the past. The other one is its mirror image, if you like, the Y chromosome, which is passed from father to son. But it also can go back, be traced back thousands of years. So those are the two. Then more recently, we've been able to look at the other chromosomes, the other DNA that we inherit from our parents. It's more complicated because these pieces of DNA are scrambled at every generation, but you can get useful information from that.
What do you mean they scramble on each generation?
Well, when you inherit DNA, let's say from your mother and your father, you only get half of their DNA. You get a sort of a random selection, and the process is so random that you can't predict which you're going to get, and it's a mixture, a random mixture of their genetic components. And so in an individual, you can't tell without testing your mother and father which of them gave you a particular piece of DNA.
Well, so let's take a look at that a little more carefully. So if we were to look at that, given that it scrambles in each generation, if we find someone 3-4 generations earlier who did something heroic or did something horrible, what's our connection to that person? Can we safely say we have some of that genetic material inside of us, or no?
Well, if you have a connection established through the traditional genealogy, which shows you are descended from that person, you're going to have some of their DNA, at least if they lived within the last 6 generations. If you have ancestors who lived before that, it's a bit of a gamble whether you've got their DNA or not. They may be ancestors on paper, but you haven't necessarily inherited their DNA.
Mm. You've said that American genealogy is very professional, and that the idea of marrying genealogy and genetics is exciting. Tell us about that marriage, genealogy and genetics.
Well, I'm certainly very impressed with American genealogists. They're very professional, very enthusiastic, and compare very well with genealogists in other parts of the world that I've come across. The marriage between the two techniques is how you get the most out of it. So, for example, you might be wanting to follow a particular surname back into the past along a paternal line, but you might come across what genealogists call a brick wall, where the records, the paper records, are not there. They've either been destroyed or they were never really created. And this is for European Americans. Now, using DNA, you can sometimes leap across that brick wall, if you'll excuse the mixed metaphor, and connect with other people who share the same surname and share that same piece of DNA. So, for example, you have, I'm sure we'll be speaking to Shannon McDonald soon, but the McDonald name could be linked through DNA to other McDonalds, even if she couldn't establish a paper link to them.
Hmm. Philip, I want to bring you in to this discussion. And, you know, I look at the psychological angle, and this is so, so popular now, looking for our roots. And as I did the research for the show, I was reminded of a children's story. And I don't recall exactly what story it was, but it was about a little bird looking for its mother. And it keeps going up to different animals and saying, "Are you my mommy? Or are you my mommy?" So do we look for where we came from in order to find out where we belong?
That's an excellent question, Dan. Yes, I mean, what we know in psychology now is that healthy people really need to be able to construct a life story that gives them meaning and purpose and a sense of coherence. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this interest in genetics is that this is exactly what we're looking for. We're trying to understand who we are and to write a particular life story that that really makes sense and has a connection to our past. I think particularly in the U.S., in a sort of multicultural immigrant nation, that this is especially important for us to give us a sense of meaning and purpose. Who are we? Where do we come from? And we know that healthy people are able to write those kinds of life stories.
I keep hearing in my office, Philip, as you know, with my patients, I hear the phrase over and over, "Is that normal?" And it's almost as though they want to make sure they're part of whatever, fill in the blanks, part of the mainstream, part of the larger family.
Exactly. We need a sense of group belonging, really. It gives us a great deal of benefit to feeling belonging to a group and a lineage. And I think that's where this heel of so much of this genealogical work is going right now.
So we're looking for identity and who we are, but this is shifting American identity. The headlines last week told us that looking at this year's birth rate for the first time indicates that European Americans are no longer the majority. So what are the implications of that in terms of our identity and who we are? I wonder if that's a lot of the struggle that we're hearing in today's political debate.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the things we know in social psychology is that when our identities are somehow threatened, as you might say, the majority identity of European Americans in the U.S., it becomes accentuated. Our interest in that becomes accentuated, and we really want to understand who we are. And I think that is part of what's happening in the U.S. and also this shift really since the 1970s towards really appreciating diversity and multiculturalism. And so the old idea of assimilation and shedding one's ethnic identity, which was so common over the 20th century European immigrants to the U.S., really shifted starting in the 1970s, and I think this is continuing today.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about DNA, we're talking about finding our roots, and as you just heard from Phil Akamak, social psychologist, we're really looking for who we are and where we came from and where we belong. We're also chatting with Brian Sykes, who is a geneticist over in the UK. Philip, just to follow up on the identity issue, it's funny, we search for identity, we struggle for it, and Zen Buddhists think that identity is an illusion altogether.
That's an excellent point.
So what is it?
Some people argue that identity does more harm than good, for example, in the context of war and conflict, and nationalist conflict in particular, which is one of the things that I study. But on the other hand, what you find is that in those kinds of contexts, that really having some kind of sense of group belonging protects people psychologically, allows them to cope, for example, with war or political violence.
How so?
So there's a burden and a benefit to identity. I think that's a good way of thinking about it or talking about it. On the one hand, identity can lead us into conflict with other groups by solidifying those boundaries. But on the other hand, if we belong to a certain group, we feel a sense of safety and protection. And that's something as human beings that I think is fundamental to our nature.
Well, coming back to those Buddhists, they would argue that if we clutch too tightly onto that identity, we can get in trouble. But if we hold our identity with a light touch, we might be more comfortable and have a sense of belonging.
Exactly. So there might be that balance between thinking about it.
Brian, I want to bring you back in. One of the things you discovered that I personally found fascinating is that the Southwestern Hispanic population contains genes that are typically found in Jewish people.
Well, that's true, but just before I answer that, I just want to add something to what Philip was saying, and that certainly genetics is very useful to allow people who have no records of where they've come from, maybe they've been adopted, or sometimes, or in the case of African Americans, there are no records kept of their origin, of that which ancestor came over from Africa, so there, DNA has been extremely useful, and I've been very impressed with the impact that it's had on people who have no real idea of where they've come from, who they're related to. And DNA, in the absence of any paper genealogy, can tell them something, and they're very keen appetite for that. Well, they're trying to establish some sort of identity.
I want to follow that up. I was very curious about that. African Americans, Jews are like that also, chased from country to country, and our records are non-existent. So what can DNA actually tell us?
Well, let's begin answering that question by thinking about African Americans. Usually, with African Americans, 95% of African Americans have this maternal piece of DNA that's come down from their matrilineal ancestors, straight from Africa. that they can use the genetic fingerprint of that piece of DNA to locate, in a rough sense, whereabouts their ancestor that was taken across the Atlantic actually came from, whereabouts in Africa. At the same time, because, I mean, many people that I've interviewed, that have had DNA tests, because their identity was deliberately suppressed by the slave owners and so forth, they've see this DNA that's come from their ancestor and which is carried in every cell of their body as almost a document that's been smuggled through their ancestors and down to them under the eye of the slave owners who wanted to destroy their identity. So that's a very, very strong impact. In the case of the Jews in the southwestern United States, it's absolutely fascinating to find that there is one particular gene. There's no sort of Jewish gene in any strict sense, but there is one particular Y chromosome that's been found abundantly amongst Jews, particularly the inherited priests, the Kohanim. And that was found in quite a few Mexicans and Americans from the southwestern states, and tracked back, genetically anyway, to the Sephardic Jews, the Sephardim, who left Spain, or were told to leave Spain, actually in the same year that Columbus discovered America, or at least the European discovery, and many of them decided to convert to Catholicism, which was the alternative being thrown out. But then when the Inquisition began its work, the Spanish Inquisition found the going was too hot and went over to the new Spanish territories in Central America and the South, what became the southwestern United States. And then still hid their Jewishness because the Inquisition moved over there. But in the last 10 years, since people have been able to find out that they might have this Y chromosome, they've been so impressed by this that they've actually converted to, formally from Catholicism to Judaism, as a result solely of the genetic test.
Fascinating story. Just fascinating story. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion about looking back at our roots with geneticist Brian Sykes and psychologist Philip Hammack Jr. And we're going to hear from someone here at WHYY, our very own Shannon McDonald, who's just taken a peek into her background, only to find some wonderful surprises. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear your story. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
For the Shins' first album in 5 years, lead singer James Mercer completely overhauled the band.
I don't want to make it seem as though my buddies who had worked with me so much in the past were not good enough or anything. I mean, that's not really it. I think I just need to move on.
Tune in to hear the result as James Mercer performs live this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about tracking our roots to find our identity. We've been talking with geneticist Brian Sykes and psychologist Philip Hammack. And now we're going to be chatting with Shannon McDonald. She's a blogger for The Feed here on newsworks.org. And she's here to share her recent undertaking.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so happy you are here. Let's start with some background. you and your brother Jeff worked with genealogists and the geneticist looking at your family tree. So why did you want to do this in the first place?
It actually came about through a grant from the Henry Louis Gates Finding Your Roots Foundation and through WNET. And because of the strangeness in my family history and a lot of questions that we've had, we decided that it would be a wonderful opportunity.
So one of the things you wanted to look at specifically was your maternal's grandfather's background, who died in 2003. So these two siblings, you and your brother, with this fine Irish name of MacDonald, set sail on your journey. So what did you learn about this grandfather of yours?
My mother's father, Carl Warwick, is a very interesting character, and we had always heard that he was possibly Native American. And through researching with the genealogical researchers, we've determined that possibly that's true, and DNA might confirm that or might not. We're still waiting for the results.
Did you get any results yet?
We have results from the mitochondrial DNA, the maternal line, and from the MacDonald name, and both trace back about 10,000 years to Europe.
Both to Europe?
Yes.
What do you know about this fellow, your grandfather?
Well, not as much as I'd like to. And hopefully the final DNA results will be able to tell us a lot more and give us more insight. But we know that he was born in 1917, Alabama. And we found a letter after he died actually explaining that he was Native American but had been born at a time where his birth certificate said that he was Negro. And it sounds like he struggled a lot with race over the years.
Hmm. What was that like for you, learning about that, Shannon?
It was sort of strange. He died in 2003, so he sort of became this whole separate person for me. We were very close, but in a grandfather-grandchild sort of way. So this has given me some insight into him as a person.
What impact did it have knowing that he was subjected to racism and this kind of injury and isolation?
I feel like it's almost still having an impact because we're still learning what was going on for him. But it was very shocking just because he didn't display any of that when I knew him. He was just a warm, loving person who always just wanted everyone to get along, which I guess is where that comes from.
I'm curious about if it changed this whole nature of what racism and other isms mean to you. Has it become less abstract and more personal?
Not quite personal yet, because there are still so many questions that we haven't been able to answer. I'm waiting for records from a school he attended for, it was called School for Colored Youth in New Jersey, and we're waiting for the final DNA results that should be able to confirm whether he was Native American.
Before you went on this journey, did you see yourself as pure Irish?
No, actually, not Irish at all. On the MacDonald side, there had been some questions about where that name had come from because we weren't able to trace it to a particular MacDonald, and we always wondered if, in fact, we were Irish at all.
So what was your identity? How did you?
We've sort of always assumed ourselves as just the general European Americans. We knew we had some German in us, but we were never able to confirm anything more specific.
And now?
And now we know there is definitely German, there is definitely Irish, possibly some other European cultures in there, and we'll find out if there's anything more.
You also discovered something wonderful about your grandfather's musical talent, even his relationship to Dizzy Gillespie.
Yes, that was probably the most incredible part of this. I knew my grandfather had always been a talented musician, but I didn't know how talented. He never really played for me. And to find out that he not just was friends with Dizzy Gillespie, but performed with him, traveled the world with him, made records with him, was such an amazing discovery.
You've got a great picture of your grandfather with Dizzy Gillespie.
Dizzy Gillespie and Quincy Jones, yeah.
Wow, and Dizzy Gillespie had something very nice to say about him, didn't he?
Yeah, we discovered a book that Dizzy Gillespie had written years ago, obviously, and he said wonderful things, including my grandfather could bend a note and talked about him like a brother. It was really remarkable.
Do you have any musical talent?
No.
One no is fine. The three no's, I get it. How about your brother?
No, not at all.
Uh-huh. And that's what he would say, I imagine.
Yes.
Yeah, so that gene didn't pass down to you guys. Do you have any regrets about doing this?
I don't have regrets. I feel like it's just been able to plug a lot of holes that I wouldn't have otherwise explored and answer some questions about my family and allow me to get to know better relatives who've already died.
Hmm. I want to bring on our other guest, but before we do, just one last question. I don't know what kind of person your personality is. We've just met, but this is a pretty private kind of business, exploring your roots, and you've done it in a very public kind of way. What's that like for you?
It's a little strange. It's something I'm definitely not used to. What I do for NewsWorks is news writing, so it's never about me, it's never personal. So this was a little difficult, but because I became so curious and so interested, that made it easier. And it also made it a little bit easier that I'm sort of discovering pieces of myself, but I'm talking about other people, other family members, so I was able to remove myself a little bit in the reporting.
I hear in the background Brian kind of chomping at the bit to join.
Oh, I am.
Come on in.
Yes, thank you. Well, it's there are two very interesting aspects. I've had a look at Shannon's genealogy on your webpage, and there are two things. Not only about your mother's father. It's a pity you haven't got the results in from that test, but it would definitely show he's a recent enough ancestor. If he had a high proportion of Native American DNA, you'll see it. And you can check that it's from him because you can also look at your mother's DNA. That's where it should be. That's how it got to you. And so that's fairly straightforward. Although perhaps this is the time to say that many people will say he's a Native American, expecting that to mean that all his DNA will be from Native Americans. Well, it almost certainly isn't, because the categories that we use are very simplified ones. And what I've shown time and again in DNA USA that there are no such things as these very straightforward categories. The mixtures, the melting pot of America, is not just between individuals, but it's within the DNA of individuals. That's one thing. But what the other aspect of Shannon's genealogy, which struck me straight away, is the MacDonald name. And looking at the genealogy, I think that there is a MacDonald chromosome, which Shannon's father and your brother Jeffrey will also have. Now, it so happens that the MacDonald, it's an Irish name, but it originated in Scotland. It originated with a man way back in the 12th century, a man called Somerled, who was a great Celtic hero. And the MacDonald clan, I did some early work on this, but it's been taken on a lot further by the MacDonald Society of America. And they'll be able to tell you by looking at the Y chromosome, if you've had that tested, as you say, or if you haven't, it's very easy to do. They'll be able to tell you whether the MacDonald side has actually come from this man who lived so many hundreds of years ago, and he is actually related to the modern living clan chief. So you couldn't have had a better name if you wanted to discover exactly where that paternal line came from. Even if it's not the chiefly line, which in my work about 35-40% of MacDonalds are, then there's so much work been done on that name and that clan by the MacDonald Society of America that you'll be able to slot in without any doubt at all into one of the known branches.
Let me interrupt you all for a minute, because we've got a lot of people who were calling up and want to join the conversation. Let's start with Hope. Hope, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very quickly, I have a couple of questions. Number one, how would someone get started? Number two, someone like me who doesn't know their genetic background because of family events, my father wasn't my real father, et cetera, totally blanked on that question. Well, okay, my third question then is, if you're from South America, how connected are the South American Indians with the North American Indians genetically? Because I happen to look very Native American in general. So those are my questions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've dialed the right number. Right? Your turn, Brian.
Okay. Well, you'd expect me to say this, wouldn't you? But if you have, if you're starting from scratch, there's no better way than to buy DNA USA. It's all in there. Very simple, not academic at all. The second thing is, about the South American and North American, they both have the same basic ancestry, which is largely Asian, but with, I think, a little bit of European added in. And I mean European from thousands of years ago. I should say that this was discovered actually rather in an underhand way without the permission of Native Americans, who actually believe a completely different creation myth, which is that they've always been there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of antipathy towards DNA testing amongst Native Americans and South Americans. Well, mostly Native and North Americans. But they're basically, Hope is right, they both come from the same genetic stock. And the third question, I've forgotten what it was, I'm afraid. It was her second question.
Yeah, well, so we start with, after we read your book, then what? You know, we talked about Shannon and the McDonald name, and you know, as you were describing that, I was thinking, where did that guy find that out? I mean, how do you do this kind of research?
Out?
There's these online, very popular online websites like Ancestry.com, but I don't think that'll give you the information, will it, or will it?
Well, I found it out because I looked at about 10,000 people from Britain and found a chromosome that was shared by the McDonalds and a couple of other Scottish clans who all came from the same ancestor. So I worked it out from that, and I did some testing on the clan chiefs. So that's how I found out about it. How Shannon can find out about it is look at the Clan Donald DNA project, and it'll all be there.
Were you aware of that, Shannon, that project?
I've looked into it. It's very dense and beyond what I know about genealogical research. I've seen it. I saw the Summerlid name, but I've had trouble sort of interpreting what it all means.
Well, there's a whole chapter devoted to that clan in DNA USA, so my advice to you, rather unashamedly, is the same as it is to Hope, and that is get a copy of DNA USA. It's all in there.
Shannon, don't worry. I think I can get you a copy wholesale.
I don't know about that.
Let's see if we can get another call on before our break. We've got Betsy on the line. Hi, Betsy.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Is this genealogy obsession of Americans unique to us? I mean, it's a fun project, as you've been covering, to see what the history is. But is this something that is simply because we are such a melting pot where people have come from all over? You know, our smaller populations, more isolated populations, like, say, the English, as, you know, interested in delving into this type of past?
Well, I want to turn to you, Philip, on this issue. Is there more of a hunger for identity in a melting pot like America than in other cultures throughout the world?
That's a good question. My sense is that there really is, and this is why I wanted to sort of touch on the history of identity and our interest in it in the United States, because, you know, really, as our society has changed, significantly in the post-civil rights era and really turned towards appreciation for diversity and identity. I think that that has changed significantly, and we're also unique in terms of being a nation that, with the exception of the Native Americans, which are now a very small part of our population, are not tied to place. So if you talk to my own background, for example, I'm half Italian, and, you know, family in Italy aren't too concerned with this sort of testing because there's an assumption that their identities are tied to that place where they already are. So I think because we don't have that, we're tied to somewhere else, and we're also in this historical era where assimilation is not the norm anymore in terms of identity, and people really want to know, where did I come from, what cultural traditions, what backgrounds, et cetera. I do think this is somewhat unique, although I'm sure Brian would know more about the extent to which this is going on in other countries.
Brian, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I guess it is something that that Americans are both very good at and very interested in. I mean, I see a lot of Americans that come over, say, to Britain and spend an enormous amount of time trying to identify the village, the parish, the tombstones even of their ancestors, and sometimes are completely bewildered when they discover that their ancestors in Britain aren't really anywhere near as interested as they are. So it may well be, as Philip has suggested, and probably is, that if you aren't from the place where your ancestors lived, then you want to find out as much about them as you possibly can.
We're going to take a short break and then come back with more discussion and phone calls. The voice you just heard was that of Brian Sykes. He's a professor of human genetics, and his new book is called DNA USA, A Genetic Portrait of America. Philip Hemmick is assistant professor of psychology at University of California in Santa Cruz. And he's written about identity in terms of narrative, politics, and sex. And I'm joined here in the studio by our very own Shannon McDonald. She's a blogger for The Feed on newsworks.org, and she has told and will continue to tell her story of her search into her roots. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And like I said before, we'd love to hear your story. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Christiana Care Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year. And the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
On the next Fresh Air, Sacha Baron Cohen talks about his new comedy, The Dictator, in which he plays the corrupt, tyrannical ruler of a fictional oil-rich nation in northern Africa.
I am for free press, fair elections, and equal rights for women. I can't say that.
Sacha Baron Cohen on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about finding our roots through genealogy, through DNA. We're talking with geneticist Brian Sykes, psychologist Philip Hemmick, and our very own Shannon McDonald, who's with newsworks.org. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Barbara on the line. Hi, Barbara.
Hey, Dr. Dan. How are you?
I'm good. What's up?
Well, my comment is, I think that genealogy is fascinating. I think it's wonderful, but I find often that people spend a lot of time and energy on the details and the dates and not as much time on the actual story behind those figures or behind that immigration or whatever it is. And I just, you know, I think that it's fascinating, it's fabulous, but I just would like to hear your experts in terms of the getting to the nuggets, getting to the legacy of that person.
Well, let me press you here a little bit, Barbara. I'm hearing not a question, but I'm hearing a statement on your part, an opinion. So let's hear it. What is it you want to say about this story?
Well, you know, I did this a couple of years ago with my dad, capturing his life story, and focused more on his tales, what he has learned from his life here. And every time I do tell somebody, they say, oh, I wish I had done that with my fill-in-the-blank. And I think it's you know, important actually to do both. But I see, like, I work with a lot of genealogists, and they're so focused on, you know, the dates and the locations, and that's all well and good, but I think that sometimes they're missing the bigger picture.
Let me interrupt you and ask you one question before we turn to our experts. What impact did this discussion with your dad have on you?
Phenomenal, in terms of just our family history and finding out details of the family history. But Dad actually is having some dementia issues at the moment. And so, you know, we were able to capture some of the flavor of growing up on the farm in Maple Shade and Cowtown Rodeo and riding that bull for 8 seconds and some of the flavor that I think often isn't tasted.
So
I
get it, and I have a feeling our guests are going to agree with you, but Shannon, when in your research, you've really done both. You've looked at DNA and you've looked at stories.
We've looked at the DNA. I did a lot of work with professional researchers to find stuff like dates and things like that. My grandparents and great-grandparents, they're all deceased. So the stories that we have to go on are all things that they've talked about in the past. I think I appreciated what the researchers were able to find because they were able to fact check a lot of things that maybe were or weren't true. I mean, my mother's father died in 2003, and he had dementia before that. Everything that we found, we only had, you know, his accounts to go by, and maybe they were accurate, maybe they weren't, but it helped to have the research to back that up.
You know, Shannon and Brian and Philip, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, they talk about something called an ethical will, where we have a moral obligation to write down for our progeny all the wisdom we've learned in life, the most important lessons, and how we've learned it. So to talk from our hearts about how we've experienced our lives, and that's such an important piece of information, and certainly can make this research a whole lot easier for future generations. Philip, I would imagine you would agree with Barbara about the importance of the narrative here, too.
Absolutely. It's very interesting because what I think the caller highlights is that there's a real limitation to just knowing that someone has a particular DNA or, you know, particular group within their DNA. They need to know the story behind it. And it's interesting because in Shannon's case about her grandfather, and by the way, it's very interesting, I identified with your story, Shannon, because I actually have a very similar situation. Unfortunately, it's on my father's side, so I can't actually do the right testing, but we have some Native American on my father's side. But when I look through the historical records, which is the only thing we can look through in that case to try to sort of find the narrative, what you find is that people tried to cover it up. And so this is the problem, is that this is like the politics of identity, right? So that some identities are valued and some aren't in different historical times. And so, particularly with some of our background, people sometimes tried to hide, and so the stories aren't there. And that's what's really, really hard. But I think if we dig, we can find the information that we need. But we need to know more than just the that, as I would say to your caller. We need to know the what story behind it, the why.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Anne Marie on the line. Anne Marie?
Hi. Hi there. Okay, so I don't really have a question, but I just want to share a little one of my own little stories. My background is West Indian. My dad is black, obviously, and so is my mother. But my dad always knew that his great-grandfather was, or his grandfather was a guy from Sweden who had traveled to Dominica to work. And he got a woman pregnant, my great-grandmother, and left. And then we heard that he was electrocuted, and that was sort of the end of the story. We had one picture of him. I kind of looked around to see if I could find more information over the past few years, never really found anything. And then about 5 months ago, I get a posting on my Facebook page from a woman in Sweden, and it turns out it is my great-grandfather's great-great-grandniece who is doing some genealogy work and suddenly discovers that there's a whole Caribbean West Indian side to the family that she had never known about because her great-great-uncle, whatever it is, I don't know how many greats, died at a young age, and no one ever talked about this other part of the family.
How exciting that must be for you, Anne Marie.
It was thrilling. And, you know, when I was a little girl, I would always sort of fantasize that my Swedish family, they were chocolate makers, and I think I'd always sort of confuse it with Swiss chocolates, the commercials you would see. And it turns out that they are Swedish chocolate makers. And
really?
That's why my great-grandfather came to Dominica to work a plantation, and their version of the story was that he died of tropical fever. Our version of the story was that he was electrocuted, and he ran off and married an American actress and was electrocuted and died at a young age.
Great. Anne Marie, thanks for a wonderful story. Brian, I'm sure you hear things like this all the time in your work.
Yes, I guess so, but that's a really good one. I mean, of course, Philip is quite right. The DNA doesn't tell you this, but it does. It maybe lets you prove the links, and it's the stories everyone's after, really. And you can show relationships through DNA, but it's not the DNA itself that is intrinsically interesting, at least not to most people. It might be to me as a geneticist. One thing that's a wonderful story, but just to pick Philip up on something, even if his Native American ancestor is through his father's line, he can still find it with one of these tests. So that's something he might want to do.
Philip, were you aware of that, Philip?
I actually wasn't. I thought that it was only able to be traced through the mother's line. I didn't realize that.
So what test would he need, Brian?
Well, it's a saliva test, and it's one that in DNA is described as chromosome painting, and it looks at the DNA from all your ancestors. In fact, I managed to trace a genealogist, a well-known genealogist from New England, who knew he had, or thought he had, a Mohawk ancestor living 12 generations ago. And we managed to find a fragment of DNA that had come down from that ancestor. Mm-hmm. And that's 12 generations, a long time. But we found it.
Philip, I want to shift gears here. I want to make sure we address this. You've been, speaking of identity, you've been working with the Israeli and Palestinian identity. And on the one hand, both have their own narratives, identities that are pretty well entrenched over the generations. But like a Palestinian friend of mine once said, after all, we're all cousins over there. So what's the research? What are you finding?
Well, it's actually very interesting because a lot of times people talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a quote, ethnic conflict. But early on in my research there, you know, I was corrected right away. Well, actually, Israelis and Palestinians think of themselves as essentially very similar genetically. They're originally from the same area, and obviously through many, many years, there's been a lot of mixing and whatnot. But there, what you find is that the identity is not really about some kind of genetic attachment. It's really about a clash of narratives, a clash of stories over which particular group deserves heirs control over this piece of land. And there you see, again, this idea that identity can really divide when people really polarize around it. But it can also provide a source of meaning, particularly in the context of war and violence. So, for example, Palestinian youth who've been exposed to violence, as a colleague of mine at the University of Tennessee has shown again and again, show remarkable resilience. And Israeli youth that I've interviewed show remarkable resilience to things like witnessing a suicide bombing, for example. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they find meaning in their struggle, which is based on identity. So it's a burden and a benefit. That's the way I like to talk about it.
Well, identity. Yeah, I was going to say that's good news and bad news. So, Professor Philip Hammack, are you the one that can bring peace to the Middle East simply by shifting narratives?
That, I think, would not fall on my shoulders, certainly not. But I do think what it does show is that if we can get leaders and educators, for example, to rewrite narratives. I mean, in this country, in the United States, we have rewritten the narrative about Native Americans. We have rewritten the narrative about African Americans and about racism and whether or not it's legitimate.
And if we could rewrite our own narratives and, like I said, hold it without a tight grasp, but with an open grasp, we might be able to relate to one another even better. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank all three of our guests for joining us, Brian Sykes, Philip Hammack, and Shannon McDonald. Thank you. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be rebroadcasting our show on concussions. Hey, I want you to know I'm going to be delivering the keynote address for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration this Friday in Washington, D.C. I'm going to be talking about fostering mental health. Well, you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com, and our production team is at voices@whyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our producer. Jerome Goldman is our summer intern. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. Devereaux support.